From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. The charged U.S. Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Justice Brett Kavanaugh highlighted the stark divide in how Americans view accusations of sexual assault and sexual harassment. One of Kavanaugh's accusers, Christine Blasey Ford, testified that she was 100% certain that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were both in high school. Kavanaugh testified he was 100% certain he didn't. One percentage that jumped out for many viewers was this figure, 23%. That's the share of women in the U.S. Senate, the body that voted to confirm Kavanaugh. In the House of Representatives, the figure is even lower. Just over 19% are women. That ranks the U.S. about 103rd in the world for the share of women in the national legislature, behind countries like Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Iraq. Now, one reason why there are so many more female legislators in other countries is that a growing number of governments have formal quotas for women in politics. This is an idea that began to take off in the early 1990s. Today, more than 60 have passed laws either mandating quotas for the number of female candidates or setting aside a certain number of legislative seats for women. In dozens of other countries, political parties ascribe to voluntary quotas. Now, these legally imposed quotas, of course, are almost always controversial, but they are growing in popularity. So on this edition of Global Journalist, we'll take a closer look at how gender quotas in politics operate around the globe. And we've got a great lineup of guests to talk about this. To kick things off, we're joined from Norberg, Sweden, by Åsa Eriksson. She's a member of the Swedish Parliament, the Riksdag, from the center-left Social Democrats. Åsa, welcome.
Thank you. Nice being on the show.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. Sweden, I understand, just had parliamentary elections. Women were elected to 44% of the seats. It's about double their share in the U.S. Congress. Tell us just a little bit about how Sweden sort of made this change. Obviously, Sweden's parliament looked much different 30 years ago.
Yeah, that's true. And we don't have any law for gender quotas. So it's a voluntary system that the political parties has formed itself. My party, the Social Democratic Party, decided, I think it was 1993, that we will have equal voting lists for all the different elections. In Sweden, you not only choose a ballot with a party, you choose a list of candidates that the party has decided itself. And since 1993, we have every second female and every second male candidate on the list. And that has made a huge impact on gender equality.
Okay, so just to clarify, because this system is, it is a bit different from the U.S. So the party actually decides which candidates from each constituency will run. And then depending on your vote share there, you can win 2, 3, 4, 0 of the slots available there. And that's why it's important that they alternate male, female then, if I understand.
Exactly, that's correct. And it's also important that we not always have men on the top positions, because if you get 3 seats, that will be 2 men and 1 woman. So we're trying to make sure that in some constituency, we have female on top. That's the case in my constituency. I'm number 3 and we have 3 seats. So from my constituency, we are 2 women and 1 man.
Okay, and so your party, the Social Democrats, adopted this back in 1993. They're a center-left party. Have parties across the political spectrum adopted similar quotas?
Well, most of them. It's not 100% that of the political parties that are using the system, but most parties are. And we have a more or less equal parliament right now. But the parties on the far right have more men than women. And our Green Party, which is to the left, they have, I think, 2/3 women in their parliamentary group right now.
Are these quotas, even though they're voluntary quotas, are they controversial? Was there resistance to them when they were imposed?
Yes, in the beginning, definitely. There were huge discussions. A lot of people, both men and women, actually were against it. And the most common argument was that the level of competence would decrease when we had more women on the voting lists. But we have a recent study from Uppsala University that has shown that it's the opposite. The level of competence and education is much higher now when we have this gender quota. system in most of the parties.
Okay, and I think we'll talk more about this later, but in other words, there were these fears that, among other things, that women who wouldn't have gotten into parliament on their own merit would be making it because of this quota system. You're saying there's some research showing that that's not in fact the case.
Yeah, that's right. And we've seen that this has spread to several sectors of the society, to the private sector, to the civil society. Nowadays in Sweden, I mean, you would be ashamed to propose a group of candidates that are only from one sex. You need to have some kind of gender mixed in the private sector, in the civil society, everywhere.
Well, can you point to sort of specific public policies or laws that have changed in Sweden as a result of this?
Well, not really, because we try to do it the voluntarily way. We don't have any laws. Well, we do have laws against discriminations, of course. You cannot pay different wages for men and women doing the same job, for instance. But it has been more of a grassroots movement. People don't tolerate male dominance anymore. We want to make sure that we have both men and women on all kinds of positions in the society.
Sure, but what about in other areas of public policy, like childcare, family leave, sexual harassment, things like this?
Yes, there we have very big reforms that has a big impact on the society. We have, I think, the world's most general laws when it comes to parental leave. In Sweden, you get 12 months paid time to stay home, and at least 3 months needs to be used by one of the parents. So in every family, at least 3 months the father will stay at home to take care of the newborn child. And in most families, there are like 50-50. Both parents take care of the household and the kids. And that, of course, has an impact on all other parts of the society.
And let me ask you, do people in Sweden view these quotas as being sort of a permanent feature of public life? I mean, given that, you know, Sweden, it's, as you mentioned, it's close to parity, at least in terms of women being represented in parliament. Or is this something that people expect to be phased out over time?
No, I think most people are convinced that it's here to stay. There are small groups, though, on the right wing who are against this, but they're quite few. And I think when you have lived in a society when there is so natural with more or less gender equality, we do have our problems here, too. I need to agree on that. But if you have seen all the good things when it comes to sharing the burdens in the household and also take equal responsibility when it comes to the professional life, I don't think you want to change that.
Well, Åse Eriksson, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
This is Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about gender quotas in politics. More than 60 countries around the world now mandate that a certain number of each party's candidates be women or reserve seats for women in their national legislatures. Now, we just heard from Swedish Member of Parliament, Åse Eriksson. She talked about how a voluntary quota system operates in her country. To broaden our discussion, we're going to turn now to Africa. We'll talk about Rwanda, where more than 60% of the lower house of parliament is female. We'll also talk about Zimbabwe, where the figure is about 32% in the lower house and 44% in the Senate. And for this, we're joined from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, by the journalist Tendai Marima. She writes regularly for outlets including Al Jazeera. Tendai, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, it's a pleasure. Let's start by talking about Rwanda. There were parliamentary elections there in September. Women won more than 60% of the seats. It seems like there's sort of a positive story to tell about women's participation there. Rwanda, we should say, does have, I think it's a 30% quota for women in parliament.
Yes, Rwanda is one country that's an exception in the sense that there is a greater political visibility of women. And in the elections that were held just now in September, about 68% of the parliamentarians that were elected are female. So that's something that's quite significant, and it's not often a situation that you might find in Africa or even in other parts of the world.
And so has this had sort of a significant impact on Rwandan society, on laws for women?
I think in some sense, yes, it has, in terms of trying to push through laws that are sensitive towards domestic violence, and also in ensuring that women's parliamentary representation remains as it is. However, I think the challenges that they may face is in ensuring that the policies that the government crafts are also gender sensitive, because that's the majority of the population. And the second challenge that is also faced in a country like Rwanda is also a question of financial inclusion. Even though women may be politically represented, there's still this question of financial inclusion and how to extend or to increase women's economic participation so that they play a greater role in the country's economy.
So in other words, in part, Rwanda, it is a relatively poor country, but it's still very often the men that control the money in the family. But I want to ask you just a bit more about the parliament, because Rwanda has also been ruled by President Paul Kagame, essentially since his army took over following the genocide back in 1994. I mean, he's a very strict authoritarian ruler. So are these women in parliament, do they actually affect public policy, or are they there more as window dressing for an authoritarian ruler who happens to be a man?
I think in some senses, yes, because women have been able to push through certain changes, like, for example, like I've said, in the area of domestic violence, or trying to shape certain policies that are sensitive towards the needs for a public health system, and also sensitivity towards the elderly. However, in some areas, it doesn't seem to be that case, that women have that much power, because in the example of, opposition voices that have risen up against Paul Kagame, the parliamentarians themselves haven't had much of a say in sort of trying to prevent some of the things that have happened, like the arrests of female opposition critics that have spoken out against President Paul Kagame.
That's right. And actually, I believe you interviewed this women's rights activist named Diane Ruigara, who tried to run against Kagame in presidential elections a year ago. But because our time grows short, let me move us to Zimbabwe. Talk to us about how quotas operate in your home country.
Okay. In Zimbabwe, we have a completely different situation. Although we have a constitution that was drafted and put into law in 2013 that provides that women should have a 50% representation in parliament. Right now, we had elections in July of 2018, and what we've had is that only 26 of the women were chosen into parliament, and the rest of the women, the women make up a total of about 118 parliamentarians, and most of those women got in through the proportional representation seat. However, the situation
I'm sorry. So we should
explain
this under Zimbabwe's system from this 2013 constitution. Something like 60 seats in a 270-person parliament were specifically set aside for women then.
Yes, that's the situation. But the reality on the ground is that women are not being elected into positions of power, but most of the women are getting in through this proportional representation seat, which only has a life of two terms. So by 2023, this policy is going to become extinct.
Okay, and so so it sounds like it's sort of mixed results there in this effort to achieve sort of a 50% female parliament there, because as you mentioned, women have only won a small share of sort of competitive seats so far.
Yes, definitely. There's only a small number of women that have been elected into parliament, and there are questions whether parliament should still continue with this policy beyond 2023. Although women's groups are pushing for it and they're trying to show that there is a need for it, amongst parliamentarians, there really is a very lax attitude. And, you know, I think the case has to be really presented to them very strongly as to why the continuation of the gender quota is necessary.
What are some of the challenges for women running for parliament in Zimbabwe? Like, are there some stereotypes?
Yes, certainly, because the way that some women are portrayed, for example, in the media or even just amongst ordinary citizens themselves, a woman who represents herself in parliament is seen as, who runs for office is seen as too strong, too outspoken, she's too much of a feminist, or if a woman is strongly critical of government, it can get to situations where a woman is actually slandered and called a name such as a prostitute or a whore. And we saw this happening continuously in the run-up to this year's electoral campaigns, particularly towards presidential candidates and also towards the head of the Election Commission, who happens to be a woman. She again was slandered because the results were described as being fraudulent and not in favor of those who were supporting the opposition. So although the opposition is a greater voice for democracy in Zimbabwe, there are still people that are very sexist as well.
And it sounds like in Rwanda, women who run for office may face similar types of pressure.
Yes, certainly, because we saw this in the case of Diane Rugwara when she was running as a presidential candidate in last year's presidential elections. As soon as she announced her candidacy, there were pictures of her that were leaked online, nude pictures of her, you know, just in a way to sort of, you know, give her a bad reputation and make her seem like she wasn't fit for office, you know. However, she's a very strong character, and she said, you know, she wasn't going to be weakened by threats such as that. And, you know, she forged ahead and did file for to stand in the elections, although in the end she wasn't able to run because her candidacy was disqualified on other terms.
Well, Tenda Marima, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about quotas for women in politics, a phenomenon that has spread to at least 66 countries over the past 25 years. Now, to broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in two researchers who have studied this issue closely. Joining us from Los Angeles is Jennifer Piscopo, a professor of politics at Occidental College. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And with us from Bath, England, is Anna Catalano-Weeks, a professor of comparative politics at the University of Bath. Anna, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me here.
Well, Jennifer, if I could start with you. You've done a lot of research on gender quotas in Latin America. I think it was Argentina was the first Latin American country to require these back in the early 1990s. Tell us how these came about and sort of how this idea spread.
Sure. So many Latin American countries had recent transitions to democracy. And so when countries have transitioned to democracy in the modern era, there has been a lot of discourse about the importance of equality, particularly gender equality, as a key plank in being democratic. And so many women in Latin American countries who had participated in the democratic transitions in their countries were able to leverage those discourses, introduce quotas as part of the democratic reforms, and say, we have participated in the social movements, the civil society protests that led to democratization, the political parties are reforming, we now want those seats at the table for electoral politics, and that this is important to do because in becoming democratic, we need to demonstrate our commitments to being equal and having equality in society. And so Argentina was the first, but many Latin American countries quickly followed.
And they spread to virtually all of South America, most of Central America, Mexico as well. But let me turn this to Anna Catalano-Weeks. You've done some research on why political parties led and controlled by men would choose to enact gender quotas. What did you find to be the rationale, since it would seem to be sort of like self-defeating for male politicians to set quotas for women?
Yeah, it's this interesting puzzle because sort of unlike in the case of South America or Central America, Europe has seen kind of a more tempered spread of gender quotas, and there's a lot of voluntary political party quotas, but not all countries have adopted laws. So there's this question of, well, you know, what motivates party leaders to adopt them? And at the end of the day, in Europe, it's been all male party leaders who had kind of the final word and were the ones responsible for pushing the provision through. And my research uncovered two different strategic reasons why it could be beneficial. And of course, you know, men can be feminists too. They can support gender equality and quotas for that reason. But there are also certain conditions under which passing a quota law can be beneficial for their political party. And one of those is if there's a rising competitor on the left. So one of these sort of new left parties or a Green Party is gaining a lot of traction and perceived to be stealing votes from perhaps a mainstream left social democratic party. I argue this was the case in Portugal before they passed a gender quota law. And another reason could be that actually a party wants to implement a voluntary political party quota, and they think that doing so would make it more appealing to more constituents. But because of the way candidate selection works, it's controlled by at the local level, and local sort of male party leaders are not receptive to the voluntary quota. They won't actually comply with it. Passing a law can be the only way to get their own party to make significant changes.
And again, we're talking about systems similar to what Åsa was talking about in Sweden, where political parties are choosing the candidates, and that's sort of a major distinction from the United States then. But Jennifer, if I could move this back to you, what kind of quota laws have you seen to be effective, and which ones haven't worked? You know, we heard some of Tendai talking about sort of the mixed results in Zimbabwe and Rwanda.
So on the idea that political election systems will differ from the United States. So in Latin America, most of the election systems are similar to Europe. The parties are running lists of candidates. And in most cases, voters will simply choose the party. So the party creates the list. The list is presented as a done deal to voters. And voters just say, I want this party, and therefore I get that list versus the other party. So a really important aspect of quota laws is that they not simply require that political parties run the specified percentage of candidates, whether that be 30, 40, or 50%, but that they require, as Åsa mentioned, that women be placed in what we call the electable list positions, so they be alternated with the male names. Because of course, if you let the parties run the specified percentage of women, but then cluster their names at the bottom of the list, the parties would have to win a lot of the vote to get to those lower list positions. So having the alternation of men's and women's names on the list has been absolutely critical in Latin America for turning the proportion of candidates into the proportion of women elected. And that has also been true, not just in Latin America, but in other countries where the quota is introduced with these list systems.
Well, Anna, if I could ask you, opponents of these laws have a number of criticisms. One is that this practice of setting aside seats for a certain gender is fundamentally undemocratic because it denies the opportunity for men to contest these seats. Another is that women who win these seats won't be seen as having gotten there on their own merit. How do you respond to those criticisms?
Yeah, this is a really popular, probably the most common argument you see against gender quotas. So you saw it again with the recent legislation that was passed in California for corporate board quotas, this contention that, well, it's going to lead to less qualified candidates for office. And I think you have to really think about what's your definition of merit. If you think that's the case, so there's been actually a lot of research done on this in many different countries. I've done research on the case of Italy with my co-author Lisa Valdez, and there's been research done in France, in a lot of different countries around the world, which finds that no matter kind of which qualifications we look at, education, professional background, previous experience within the party, etc. The women who come in through the quota laws are just as qualified as the men. And in fact, my research in the case of Italy showed that, subsequent to their election, the quota women who came in were actually more competent in office, in the sense that their attendance levels were higher, so they were more likely to actually show up to the parliament and do their jobs. So I think that it's really unfounded, and we should consider that, if we think that there are equal talent pools for both men and women, then we should question, this idea that merit is the thing, that a quota is going to lead to less qualified candidates for office.
Well, Jennifer Piscopo, if you could pick up on this. In the United States, of course, this idea of gender quotas in politics seems not to have much traction, even as it's spread sort of globally. Why do you think that is? Why do you think people in the U.S. seem to view things differently?
I think there's a technical reason and then there's a normative reason. And so the technical reason is that gender quotas would be difficult in the United States given the uniqueness of our election system. So in the United States, anybody can step forward and become a candidate. Candidates register themselves with the local election commission. And parties really have very little control over who steps forward and says, I'm a Democrat, I want to run for office, or I'm a Republican and I want to run for office. In the vast majority of other countries, parties register the candidates. Parties control the candidates in primaries that are often closed just to the parties. So they're not these open primaries the way we think of them in the United States.
So it wouldn't be very feasible to try to control how many men or women go into Congress, when really anyone can run and anyone can vote for whom they choose to in the U.S. then.
Exactly. We could think about ways to introduce those kinds of controls, but they would require a lot more building on some deep-seated norms about how our election system works. I think the second reason is, in the United States, we have a particular historical background around affirmative action. We have a particular set of anxieties about it that come out of a history of racial discrimination in the U.S., and so we think about affirmative action in different ways and in very contentious ways. Now, to underscore what Anna said, there really is no grounds for the criticism that quotas bring forward less qualified women. In the United States and in other countries, we see that women were 50% of political party members. Women were extremely active in politics. The difficulty, very similar to the corporate environment, was being selected to stand for a powerful position because, of course, those positions are largely held by men and they want to preserve their power by having folks like them. But I do think, given the United States' racial history and the very difficult conversations around that, affirmative action for women has also been a very difficult conversation. In Latin America, for instance, benefiting groups based on their identity, be it race, be it gender, is a much more accepted part of how they think democracy and social democracy and equality and fairness work. So even though there is contention over quotas and affirmative action, there is a higher level of understanding that there is structural discrimination against groups and that the law can be used to remedy that discrimination. In the United States, that's much more contested.
Well, Anna Weeks, our time does grow short. Do you see that these sorts of laws are something that might be likely to be needed sort of indefinitely in a number of countries, or is the idea that they will phase out over time? We heard Asa talking about the case of Sweden, which of course is ranked as one of the most sort of gender equal nations in the world, and yet Asa saw the need for these sorts of quotas, these rules, to continue.
Yeah, I think we're not there that yet. I think that ideally, in the perfect world, we wouldn't need any quotas. But we have to think about inequality in the household, in the workforce, and in politics as sort of things that are intertwined. And so, as just for me, you know, just so long as you know there are unequal caretaking roles in society, and unequal positions of power in the workforce. This suggests to me that we're still going to need those quotas for women in politics for some time to come. So basically, in the future, when you can see a world in which men and women take on all kind of responsibilities equally, then you think, well, there wouldn't be any need for a quota because there shouldn't be that discrimination in being selected or coming forward. But I don't think we're there yet. And also political parties, once they have the quota, don't seem to mind it. So even parties of the far right that I spoke to in Belgium, for example, they're happy the law was implemented. Now they think it's improved the political party, even though they were very much against it at first.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Asa Erickson, Tendai Marima, Jennifer Piscopo, and Anna Catalano-Weeks. Our assistant producers this week are Elliot Bauman and Shirley Tay. Our supervising producer is Yanqi Xu, with visual editor Maggie Duncan. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.